My name is Suzanne LeGrand, and I am here with Chris Wilson, who is the author of The Master Plan, My Journey from Prison to a Life of Purpose. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I don't know if anyone else has done what you did, which is to go from a life prison sentence to talking a judge into reducing your prison sentence and getting out. To start, could you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what it was like?
Yes, I grew up in Washington, D.C., Northeast, around, I guess, late 80s, early 90s was the time I was there. And it was pretty segregated, just like, you know, all black people, like, in my neighborhood. Very, very violent, a lot of drugs. This was around the time when the crack epidemic was sweeping through our communities. And so it was a lot of gun violence, unfortunately, in our neighborhood. So it was a pretty tough time.
Yeah, and some people describe that time or the situation of some of those neighborhoods almost like being in an outdoor prison. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And especially it was the mindset of, like, the people in our neighborhood. Like, we had been through, like, so much, and there was so much stuff going on that, like, no one even, like, thought about, like, you know, whether or not they could, like, do something different or like, be successful. We were just trying to, like, get through and survive. And so it was very, very strange time for me in my life.
When you say people were going through a lot, like, what sort of things were people going through?
So almost everybody that I knew, like, growing up, when I was going to school, like, their dad would, like, be in prison or wasn't in their life. It was just, like, it was a lot of police harassment. Like, our schools, the way our schools were set up, they were kind of like prisons, even though our teachers were, in my experience, our teachers were great. But our community was just like messed up. There was drugs everywhere on every corner. And it was just a strange experience.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people talk about how young people of color, particularly African-American men and women, are kind of tracked towards prison. Do you think that's true?
I don't think people of color are like tracked towards prison, but I do believe that there has been a racist system and policies put in place that was designed to prey on people of color and make things. So if you could look at, like, redlining, denying people, like, access to loans to buy their homes, set up policies where, you know, you militarizing your police force and giving them quotas so they got to lock people up, and you're taking people's right to vote. And, like, all of these things, when you add them all up, it excommunicates the communities of people of color and doesn't allow them to participate. And so as a result, like, they don't, you know, they can't move up in America, and they suffer from it, and they ended up going to prison. And, like, the prison system, like slavery never went away. Like, it just metamorphosized itself into something different. It went from, like, slavery to Jim Crow and, like, all these different types of policies, the crime bill. And it's just a way to oppress communities of color, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the educational system that you experienced when you were growing up? Did that play a role how?
So that was a critical role in my life. And even when I was in, like, elementary school, my teachers, it would be like shootings outside of the school, but our teachers would have us in that classroom, even when stuff was going on outside, and they would stress to us the importance of education. And they would tell us, like, you know, the system may want to lock you up and people might want to, like, take stuff from you, but no one can take knowledge from you. Like, if you learn and you, like, study and educate yourself, then you can be successful in life. And so that was something that I remembered from a child. And when I eventually, like, went to prison, that was, like, something that I truly embraced, because I knew I was always book smart. I could read really well, even as a young kid when I was, like, 8. Like, I was reading above my level. But I never applied myself because my friends would tell me, like, man, that's lame. You want to read books all day. And I didn't play sports, and so they would tease me. And so I never applied myself. So at a certain point, I decided to, like, embrace my education.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And education was a big, played a big role in your transformation.
Yes, it still does. Mm-hmm. It still does. I'm a lifelong learner. That's what I call myself.
Yeah, yeah. So before we talk about that, let me just ask you, was there any way in which the educational system you experienced growing up, you think kind of also discouraged people in some ways? Or because it sounds like you had some encouragement from some teachers that, that stayed with you. Were there any ways in which the educational system also was discouraging or served as a barrier for people?
So I would say no in my experience. But I think, unfortunately, like there were so many things that were stacked against me growing up in my community. Like I love school. Like I used to win awards for like not missing a day for the entire school year for attendance. So I loved it. But there's so much stuff that went on, like leaving school and or even trying to get to school and go home from school, that those things overcame like the power of education.
Can you speak a little bit about that? Like what was hard about getting to school?
So with so much gun violence in my neighborhood, and as a young kid, I would have to try to plan my routes just to get to school. I would walk to school and it would be shootings, it'd be dead bodies, and I try to have to figure that out. But the deeper impact of that is the trauma that I experienced from all the stuff that I saw. Like I would have to go to school and it'd be like a shooting, and I'll see like a young girl get shot by a stray bullet, and she would die, and we would watch her die. Like the police wouldn't come because it was a tough neighborhood. It'd take them like 35 minutes to get there, and then I would have to go to school, and my teachers would you know try to explain work to me, but I couldn't concentrate. All I would think about was what I just saw, or I couldn't sleep at night. And a lot of young people who witness stuff like this in the communities, they experience it, and it's hard for them to learn in school or focus because, like, we don't understand what we saw. Like, it's trauma.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people are, kids are coming to school traumatized.
Yeah.
And the educational system is saying, okay, open your book. and not paying attention to kind of what's happening. Do you think this is a, for kids, this is a common experience, this kind of trauma?
Absolutely, it's a common experience. I went to a school 2 days ago here in Baltimore City, and it's a very, very tough neighborhood. The entire high school was surrounded by vacant houses. And this young guy, I spoke to the kids, and I was talking about the book. And this young guy didn't speak during the whole time. And afterwards, he pulled me up, and he was like, I don't want to talk in front of everybody. And he started telling me, he was like, you know, my dad, disowned me and my brother. My mom is bipolar. Like, I watched several of my friends get killed. And my mom's thinking about killing herself. She's been talking about it. And, like, I just feel alone. He was shaking while he was talking to me. And I felt like I was talking to my younger self. And this happens often, like several times a week. And so we got to do something to address this issue that happens in these communities, especially with our young people.
What do you think could be done? I mean, this sounds like this is happening a lot. And so, I mean, do you have a sense of how the educational system could respond differently or help these kids?
Yes, I do, actually. I think so. A couple of things. Like, one, I think teachers should be educated. And most of them are, though, but like they should be educated and provided with resources to help our young people who experience this trauma. So like when I was growing up, somebody get killed or something happens on the school grounds or something, and they just like get back to work. And it's like these experiences, kids' brains aren't developed, so they can't process what they just saw, what they just experienced. And so we should be providing therapy for our young people who experience like traumatic experiences. And just talk and allow them to talk about and ask questions about like what they saw. Cause like a lot of stuff that happened when I was young that I saw, I just didn't understand. I used to ask my grandmother, grandma, like who we at war with, like, why is there so much shooting? Like I thought like, you know, the war was over in America and she couldn't explain it to me. Like we just didn't understand. And so we gotta do more things that is proactive mm-hmm. towards our young people. Try to get them to understand what's going on.
In your book, you talked about a lot of gun violence when you were growing up, but you also talked about domestic violence. And,
yeah.
And in fact, you noted that that was kind of the point in your life where things really went downhill when your mother got involved with the wrong man, as you put it.
Right. Yes. I mean, for me, and I think I could speak for most young people, like your mother is like the person that like that's how you learn about love, unconditional love. Like, you know, I love my mom more than anyone in this world. And to watch someone, and she was a nice person, she was smart, she was ambitious, and to watch like someone, especially even me as a police officer, just watch him like beat my mom and like talk down to her and stuff like that, it was painful, and I didn't understand it, and I felt helpless, and that was something that just made me an angry young man. Growing up, I just was angry about that, and I would take it out on other people.
Yeah. Do you think that domestic violence plays also a role in what's happening to some of the kids who are coming to school?
I think so, but I think the cause is a deeper, it's a very deeper discussion, right? And I so like when I got out of prison, I was doing workforce development, and I would see a lot of my clients. Experience like domestic violence, and you got to think about it, right? Like in a relationship, let's just take like the black man for example, like deny access to like adequate like resources to get work, to take care of their children. You got the police coming after you. You got to be like safe in your neighborhood, and there's so much that's stacked against the black man, right? And you know, some people can't handle all that stress, and they self-medicate, they drink, they do drugs and stuff. And they're under pressure, and, you know, sometimes, like, they get in disputes. I see it a lot with people that I employ where their partners are just like, you need to earn more, and, like, don't come home till you get more. And it's just, like, it's a lot of stuff. And so it's a big issue. It's just something we should talk about more.
Yeah, yeah. And also a big stress on black women, too.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, that's the other thing, too. When I was doing workforce development and a lot of stuff I see, like a lot of the black women, they got to take on the roles as being a mom and a dad. And they got to do so much with so little. And it's sad. It's sad.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about your time in prison and also kind of what you did with your time in prison. Could you just explain a little bit about how you ended up in prison?
Yes. So after my mom and I were attacked by this police officer, and he knocked me unconscious. And when I woke up, he was raping my mom, and he tried to kill her. But she survived. We both survived. And after that, I started carrying a gun because he got a little bit of time. He got out, and he started stalking our family. And so we all started carrying guns, even my sister. And my brother got shot a couple times. He survived. My cousin got shot 17 times. He passed away. And a few months after that, I was just by my house, and some men started following me. And I went to a space where there was a lot of people, like a gas station, a 7-Eleven. And I was like, they probably won't bother me here. I had a gun on me, though, but I just didn't want to use it. And they came after me, and one guy tried to get behind me, and they were threatening me, saying they knew where I live at, my family, and they were going to kill us. And I fired my weapon at one of the guys who was trying to get behind me, and they ran away. And I found out a few weeks later that I took a person's life, and I was charged as an adult and sentenced to natural life in prison.
Why were you charged as an adult when you were 17?
Well, after the 94 crime bill that was put in place in this country, they just felt like, you know, what do they call it, super predators, and that, you know, we need to be locked away. And it was like this, you know, tough on crime approach. And even if you was a child, like they would treat you as an adult because they felt like our lives wasn't redeemable, which is unfortunate.
So can you talk a little bit about what life was like in prison when you went there? You went there into an adult prison at 17 years old with a life sentence.
Yes. Right. I mean, it was the equivalence of being teleported to another planet. different rules. Like, it's very, very strange. And again, like, I was a child, I was small. I went to prison. I think I was like 120 pounds. Didn't have a mustache, and it was crazy. It was a nightmare, and I was terrified. I was like, I don't know how I'm gonna survive in here. And I fell into a depression for my first year in prison, and then something clicked. Like, I met a person, a guy, Steven, who also had a life sentence, who was studying software, and he had these dreams that he would get out one day and he was gonna be successful. And I was motivated, and so I decided to go to my cell and write up kind of like a bucket list, but I call it my master plan of things that I wanted to do. But the most important thing is I wanted to prove to myself and to everyone else that that I was intelligent, that I was a good person, and that I could be free one day. And I wanted to give back to people. And so that was like the genesis of creating the master plan.
So you have a life sentence, and you met this guy who also has a life sentence, and both of you decide to create your future as if that is
right.
Not the case. How in the world did you do that? I mean, a lot of people would have accepted their fate, but you, for some reason, what was it that made you decide that you were going to have a different future?
So there's a couple things. Like, first, like, I'm a stubborn person. And so I think I like applied my stubbornness in a positive way, though. In the book, I call it a positive illusion, where you believe that it's going to happen. But the other thing is, I was motivated by my friend, and I've always been a dreamer, and I used to dream about just like being able to travel and like do stuff. And I just chose to believe that my life, I wasn't put here in this world to spend the rest of my life in prison. Cause like, you know, it's unfortunate. I did take a person's life, but I didn't start it. I didn't come after these people. I didn't want to do it. And so it happened. And I was like, how can my life be over? And it was like, and then I was looking around. I was seeing so many people who looked like me, who were just stuck in prison and going through all this stuff. And I decided, it was like, you know, I'm going to figure out a way how I can get out of prison and be a positive example to people. I want to break this cycle. And that's how it all started right there. And it was a leap of faith.
And so how did you do it? I mean, how you actually decided you were going to have a different future, but you were in prison for life. And
right.
So everything around you wouldn't support that story. So what did you do to make that a reality?
So the main thing that I focused on was education. I could, like, so for example, I could pick up a 300-page book and I can read this book in like a day and a half or 2 days, tops, and I could remember everything that I read, right? So I was like, all right, well, how about I figure out what I want to do in my life? What's my end game? Who do I want to be when I'm, I say, 40 years old? And then I'll work backwards towards that. And so I was like, okay, I made up a list of things that I need to do. I was like, all right, I'm going to get my high school diploma. Like, my parents and family members will always get on me about it. So I started studying, got my high school diploma in 2 months. I said, okay, what else we have? Vocational shops, carpentry, plumbing. And it's a 2-year program. I did it in 13 months. So I was like, well, and it started building up my confidence. And I was like, well, maybe I am intelligent. So I started studying foreign languages and reading books. And then the college program came, and then I got into college. And that's when I just like it really opened my mind to how big the world was and like what was possible. And thankfully, even after I got my college degree, they allowed me to continue to study. It was like I was like a special project. They would just like give me books to read and like, you know, do research on the internet and just really like push me. And then throughout that whole time, I was going to therapy and I started opening up and started really digging into like my issues as a person.
Could you talk a little bit about how education opened you up, as you said?
Yeah, so a couple things. Like I remember like taking history classes and just reading about people who, like, and it was a different era, obviously, like back in the day, hundreds of years. But people just, like, doing, like, amazing things, building cities and stuff. And I started reading about the civil rights movement, and I felt bad. And I would look around, all I would see is black people in prison. And I was like, man, like, folks, like, would do sit-ins. They would get dressed. Children would get locked up. People would have food poured on their head, all that, just for, like, equal rights, civil rights. Right. And I was like, so I felt bad and I felt moved to like prove that or pick up the torch and finish the fight. And so that was something that I was like, you know what, I got to start studying, and nobody can take what I have in my head, my knowledge. And then I started mentoring other people, and I would see the change in people. And people, you know, I would mentor a guy with like 40 years, and he'd get into college, he'd get into therapy, and like do all this stuff. And like in a few years, he'll go back to court and get his sentence reduced. And then he'll go home, start his own business, start a family and stuff, and like, and stay out of prison. And I would do that like often. And so I realized like that was like the magic sauce.
Your experiences of education in prison are incredible. Are these typical experiences? I mean, do most people who are in prison have access to high school education, vocational education, college education?
I think so, right? So the first two, most people have access to, and I think there's laws, like if you're under 21 at least, if you go to prison, there is mandatory that you go to school. I'm not sure if you have to graduate, but there are a lot of vocational programs inside of prison and college programs here and there. And our college program at the prison I was in was something that was funded for the federal Pell Grant, where some federal money trickled down on the state level, and they kind of just experimented with us. And I think it was like 150 of us that ended up getting into this college program. But everyone who got into the program ended up going home and became successful, and none of them went back. And there's data all over the place that supports that even a little bit of like college education reduces the recidivism rate. So I'm an advocate for like having college in every prison, because it keeps people from going back to prison, which is what we want.
Absolutely. So a lot of people in this country have this attitude that if somebody has committed a crime, they should be punished, and they should be punished harshly. And right, the harsher, the better. And they associate that with justice. What right. do you think about that mentality? Is that a way for people to learn from their mistakes?
So I don't agree with that completely, right? But that being said, if you do commit a crime, I feel like you should be punished, right? That's fair, right? That's a part of justice, right? But I think, at least in America, we put too much emphasis on the punishment aspect, and especially victims, right? Like the victims, at least in my experience in the Black community, the victims eventually become the victimizers, right? So we gotta start supporting my victims who experience crimes and providing therapy for them. But that being said, if you commit a crime, yeah, you should be punished. And, like, not for the rest of your life, not 30 years for a $20 bag of drugs, right? So I think we shouldn't do that. But what we should do is focus on, if we call it a correctional facility, if someone has to go to prison and taxpayers are paying for it, then we want that person to get some help when they're behind the fence. Like if someone breaks into your car and like steals your radio, you don't want them to go back to prison. You mean you want them to be punished, but you don't want them to sit in prison and learn how to be a better thief, and they get out and they're just like, you know what, I can disarm your alarm system in your house, and they come break into your house. Like you want them to get help because we're paying for it anyway. So we want them to come out and say, you know what, instead of breaking into cars, I learned how to fix cars and repair them, you know, and you know, sell cars or whatever, instead of like breaking into them. And so that's what I see. Prison should be, it should be success factories.
And are they right now?
They're not. There are like a small percentage of people who take it upon themselves to teach themselves or take advantage of the programs that's in there. And they get out and they're successful. But as a society, we should want everyone to go into prison. So like, all right, you messed up and you losing your freedom is your punishment. But while you're here, use this time to better yourself so you can get out and not hurt anybody else, and live a successful life, live a beautiful life.
Do you think that the other prisoners were like you, that they had been through some major traumas?
Yes. So for my first 2 years in prison, I wouldn't talk in therapy because I felt like no one would be able to relate to my story. And eventually when I opened up in therapy, other people started opening up, and I realized we all were going through like the same stuff. Moms getting beaten up in front of them, gun violence and trauma and fighting. And so I think it was healthy. Like, it's painful, it's hard to do, but I believe it's a sign of strength to open up and talk about these issues.
Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of other people that you were in prison with who had also suffered from serious traumas in their life.
Absolutely.
Were they also, did they also have access to education before they got to prison, just out of curiosity?
I mean, so I think they did, right? But like the quality of education that they had access to was questionable.
Why is that?
Well, like you go to a school that has outdated books, or just like all kinds of stuff going on in the school. Like how do you expect a child to get a good education in a school like that? And a lot of people that I met in therapy, like I used to hear, I mean, I see it now. I'm here in Baltimore and some of the schools. Like, how do you expect a child to be successful that's going through so much stuff at school or just being denied so many, like, resources? Even, like, clean drinking water was limited, like, in the community. Like how was that the case?
Yep. So let's talk a little bit about how you ended up getting out of prison even though you had a life sentence. Could you tell that story?
Yes. So while I was embarking on my educational pursuits, I was every time I accomplished stuff in like therapy sessions and graduate from vocational shop, I would reach back out to the courts and I would be denied because the political climate in the state of Maryland, when you get sentenced to a life sentence, you usually grow old and you die there. And so I was frustrated. But like at a point of like 10 and a half years in prison, and being denied five times, I was mentoring this young guy one day, and he was like, you know, I don't understand why you can't get out. And he was like, I see all these people get out of prison, and then they come back, and then they get out, and you stuck in here, and you helped all of us, but, like, you can't get a shot. And he was like, you know, I don't want to get too religious with you, but maybe, he said, I never hear you talk about God, so maybe that's what's missing from your life. And at the time, you know, I believed in God, I just didn't understand God. And so I literally like just went to my cell and just started praying for a sign from God. And I used to ask God, I was like, you know, just show me that what I'm doing right now, that I'm on like the right track and that I could get out. And I ended up getting a court date like a few weeks later after that. Honestly, it was a miracle.
Wow. That's amazing. And what happened at the court date?
I mean, at the court date, I had an opportunity to apologize to the courts for like the crime that I committed. I also had an opportunity to talk about all the things that I've been through in my community as a young man, and just being angry and just trying to convey the experiences. And I talked about all my educational accomplishments and what I would do if given a second chance, that I would commit my life to being successful, to giving back, to volunteering, and just like doing the right thing. And I know it was like a stretch, but they took a gamble on me and they gave me my second chance. So I've just been trying to pay it forward ever since.
So you had a life sentence, but you ended up getting a reduced sentence and you got out after 16 years.
Yes.
And when you got out, a lot of people who are ex-felons encounter incredible barriers to starting a new life. Was that also true for you?
Yeah. I mean, it was scary. It was tough. But I was lucky. I mean, it took me 52 days to find a job. But I had started a career center when I was in prison. So I knew, like, the number one way how you find a job is through relationships. And so I was maintaining relationships with folks to try to figure out how to get a job. But there were all kinds of barriers, especially having to check in like twice a week with the probation officer once out of prison. And it's like, how do you maintain a job when you got to leave work twice a week, like to take a urinalysis, and then you got to pay for the urinalysis, and you're like not even making money yet. But the biggest barrier for me, or I think for most people, is the psychological aspect of, you know, being in prison for so long and getting out. And just, like, not having anything. Like, I didn't have a car. I didn't have, like, I had a $10 phone from Radio Shack. And I was 32 years old. And I would see people my age, and they have, like, families, houses, cars and stuff. And, like, that messes with you psychologically. And so most people, they revert back to, like, what they knew before they went in, because they want to move fast. They want to get their lives back together. Or they have responsibilities to take care of their children. So it's tough.
And how did you manage to overcome these things? I mean, it sounds really tough. I mean, and let me just ask you, so you were required to check in twice a week during work hours and pay? How much did you pay?
Yeah. Like $40 per your analysis.
So you had to pay $80 a week for this?
Okay. Yeah, so the way it works was, when you first get out, like, you got to check in for, like, the first month or two, twice a week. And then, like, the third month is once a week. And then, like, the fourth month, if you do okay, then it's, like, once a month. But, like, you pay for that. And even being out, like, you got to pay restitution. Like, I had, like, several thousand dollars of restitution to pay. And I don't even know what it was for, but I had to pay it. And everyone has to pay it. And then, like, when you can't pay it, you know, that goes on your record. Like, you could be, like, violated on your parole and probation just for, like, not being able to do it. And it's just a lot of pressure.
So, okay, let me see if I'm understanding this. So you have all of these bills that you immediately have to pay upon getting out, but you don't have access to getting a job. And if you don't pay them, you can end up back in jail. Is that right?
Absolutely. Which is, I mean, it's suspicious, right? You think about it, it's like, well, like, the deck is already stacked against them. Like, why is it so, like, tough? I used to ask sometimes my parole officer, like, where does this money go to? Like, what's the money for? Does it, well, I mean, like, if it goes to the victim's family or something like that, then, like, I could understand it, but it doesn't. And it was like, it goes to us. And I was like, well, what do y'all need money for? You're already getting paid. And it's just like, we just need it. But, like, so it's a mechanism to get people back in prison. Like, it has been turned into a business now. Like, people got to keep beds filled.
Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, I read someplace that it costs more to keep somebody in prison per year than it does to send them to Harvard.
Right. Absolutely. So the way it works, right? You know, person commits a crime or whatever, and they go into prison, but, like, policies are put in place, like, to get people off the streets, to, like, fill quotas, meet quotas and stuff. And so you have these people in prison, right, unfortunately. And then there's all these private prisons and private companies that provide services and stuff to these prisons, like commissary, like, you know, coffee and stuff, phone calls and everything at, like, these crazy, like, rates that, you know, super expensive. For example, like, when I was in prison, the average person makes $25 a month. It's $10 for a 30-minute phone call, right? So, like, that's predatory. And so all these things happen, and what they do is they give the prisoners a kickback on all the money that they make every month, right? And then they lobby, right? They lobby politicians, and they give them money to keep, like, these policies in place. And politicians have put all kinds of stuff in place, like, you know, prisons make furniture, they make license plates and stuff that goes on signs for cars and businesses. And then on the state level, they'll pass legislation that says you got to do business with these prison companies. Like, you got to make them a priority. And so it's just like how the prison system was back in the day with, like, slavery and Jim Crow, convict lease system, I think was what it was called. And it's unfortunate. And so, and that being said, like, politicians are going to want to keep beds filled because they're going to want to, these corporations that's funding them, they're going to want them to make money so they can give kickbacks to the prison and finance, like, their campaigns and stuff. So it's been happening for a long time all over America.
So let me just understand this. So if you have to pay $10, you said, the average prisoner makes $25 an hour and a phone call.
A month. Not an hour, a month.
A month. Right. A month. Yeah. Okay. So an average, so a prisoner makes $25 a month and a 30-minute phone call is $10. Who sets that price?
The private prison company, the phone company. Ours was called, like, Securus, right? And they set the price. It's the law of scarcity. We're the only ones that can allow you to call home. So if you want to call home, you got to pay a price. And what happens is a person might spend that $10 on that phone call, or they might buy some hygiene products, but the family can also incur that price. So a family said, all right, I know you already have it like that, so I'll pay for this $10 call. And then maybe you want to call a couple of days later, and that's another $10, and that runs the phone bill up to hundreds of dollars. And so it's not only punishing the inmate, it's punishing their family.
So, and then they're also paying $25 a month,
right,
for full-time labor.
Yeah.
So where is this, you know, $70,000 a year that it costs to house a prisoner? Where is that money going? Because it doesn't sound like it's going to actually it doesn't sound like that money is being spent on the prisoner itself themselves.
That's a great question, right? And I don't know if I have the answer to it. I've asked it sometimes when I was in prison. They would say, well, it's all about security. Like, we, you know, they'll buy a new fence, they'll buy some new security cameras and all that. And it's just like, this is in the interest of protecting our employees and protecting the public. But it's definitely not going to like college programs and stuff. Like, this is a business. So like, they're making money off of prisoners. And mm-hmm. so like, this is a thing, and it has to stop.
Mm-hmm. I read a book once that was called The Rich Get Richer and the Poor Get Prison. And, you know, I'm wondering if that is, you would say that is kind of what's happening here.
It's definitely happening. Like, it's an instrument of control. Folks who are in power, they want to stay in power. And so this is a way, like, to suppress and oppress, you know, people, especially people of color. Like, this stuff was put in place deliberately.
So let's talk a little bit about when you got out of prison and you somehow managed to get through that period of having a lot of bills and not having a job, and then you got a job. What happened? How were you able to give back? Because that was your plan all along.
Right. So it started, once I got my job, it started with me like stabilizing my life. I got an apartment. I brought a bicycle and to get back and forth to work. And I started holding workshops in the community. And like, I would work and then I would do a workshop. And then I'll go to class or go to class and do a workshop. And I'll do it even on my days off.
A workshop on what?
Entrepreneurship. And so the community that I was working in, it was a lot of people who like was just making money and working like in the shadow economy, like not paying taxes or whatever, or just like odd jobs, like babysitting and like moving, hauling like debris and like all kinds of stuff. And so I was in business school. And so I would learn stuff in the classroom and I would hold workshops with them and try to get them like set up, get them like into like the real economy and like paying taxes and building up lines of credit with like financial institutions to grow like their businesses and hire employees. And so I saw value in that. And so I started doing that for a while. And then eventually, like one of the people in the group was like, why you don't have your own business? Right. And I was like, hold up. Yeah, that's part of my plan. I need to start my own business. And so I started my first business, which was a furniture company, and started repairing furniture and making furniture. And then I started another one. I started a construction contracting business. And it was very rewarding to be able to provide paychecks to people. And I would tell them sometimes, like, listen, you don't got to look over your back. Doesn't it feel good when you get this check? This is like an honest living. And so it was very rewarding for me.
And it seems like, given that there are so many barriers to employment for ex-felons, that entrepreneurship is really one place where people can remake their lives. Would you say that's
absolutely
true?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And, you know, like, the truth is, like prisoners, like inmates, are some of the most innovative people, like, in the world. You have nothing but time. So, like, all you, you know, some people just sit for like days, weeks, months, years, just trying to figure stuff out. And if you channel like that, that energy and like something positive, like entrepreneurship, like you know, you'll be unstoppable. Mm-hmm. And it's legal. Like, it's like you don't have to go back to like a life of crime.
So a couple questions about that. when you were teaching entrepreneurship and teaching people about lines of credit, was it easy to get credit as an ex-felon?
It was almost impossible. So I went to every bank, and even when I started making money, I was making $13,000-$20,000 a month. And I try to get a line of credit, a revolving line of credit monthly for like $5,000. Couldn't get it. I needed all this collateral. I needed like 2 years of like tax returns. And I was like, I just started my business and I'm making money. I had contracts and they would tell me no. But like later, years later, I found out it was because of my criminal background. They felt like I was risky. They just wouldn't want to deal with me.
So it's not just...
And it happens to so many people.
So it's not just that you have to check off that you have a criminal record on a job application. It actually prevents you from getting a line of credit. Is there any other barrier that is kind of a common barrier that people might not know about?
I don't know. The credit thing is a real big deal. Raising capital and stuff like that's even more difficult. But like the credit thing is something that's super, super essential to allow people like to move up economically. So that's the biggest thing I would think of.
Mm-hmm. So now you have several businesses, right? And you have a best-selling book. What's next for you?
So I started painting 2 years ago, making fine art. And I've been doing shows and selling my work all around the world. And to be honest with you, I fell in love with painting. And so I want to do that. I started my foundation, the Chris Wilson Foundation. So I've been doing some philanthropy work, which is super, super rewarding. And there's something special about being able to identify another Chris or Christine, like in the world, that's like trying to like turn their lives around and be able to support them and not want anything in return other than for them to be successful. And so that's what I'm really excited about right now.
So how did you find painting? That's really an interesting thing. Yeah, a lot of people wouldn't think that, you know, the fine arts is where you would go next, but obviously that's something you're good at and successful at too, which is not easy.
I don't know. My friend who's an artist, I was doing a lot of work for artists as a contractor, like moving their stuff around. And then my friend, Jeffrey Kent, who's a Baltimore-based artist, he gifted me so a couple art lessons. And I remember one day he sat down with me and he was like, art should mean something. And he was like, think about stuff you care about. And I was like, criminal justice reform. And he was like, all right, good. And he was like, it should look good and, you know, get to work. And I started working. And just the process of making art, it was cathartic. It made me happy. And people started paying money for it. And I was able to, like, start telling powerful stories about gentrification and like, you know, the opioid epidemic in America. And I was making money off of it, and I just fell in love with it. I just think it's fascinating. It's powerful.
People say that art saves lives, but I've also heard people say that creativity is a way that people can heal, that, you know, therapy is one aspect of healing, but creativity allows you to heal in a different way. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I can't really like put my finger on actually what, you know, but I believe it's true. Like it's one of my happiest moments when I could just be by myself and just creating some stuff, and I just feel great. It's cathartic. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think I'll ever stop.
So having gone through all of these experiences and feeling very strongly and being a strong advocate for helping people who have gone through the criminal justice or maybe injustice system, what would you say needs to change for us to really see a big difference in what's happening right now, and in order to stop also the kind of experience that you had?
Right. So I think instead of this get tough on crime approach to prison, we should think about, we should make prison rehabilitation centers And so we should put more focus on education. We should also get rid of these mandatory sentencing laws and allow more discretion for our prosecutors and judges to look at individuals who commit crimes by case by case. For example, like you can look at a child who's been like abused for all of his life and was put in a situation or whatever, maybe some drugs or he killed somebody or something happened. That child, like those factors should be considered in the sentencing. And maybe if like you got to get that child 30 years or whatever, right? You should be able to bring that child back some years later to give them opportunity to be released if they like educate themselves, they can go through therapy and they do all the things they need to do to be productive in society. They should be able to get out of prison. Mm. Like we shouldn't turn prison into a business. We shouldn't, you know, it just doesn't make sense. And like economically. It just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of education, what kind of education do you think would make a real difference in people's lives, both in prison and also maybe outside of prison?
I believe in college education. America is a country that's all about hard work. Also, consumerism, so like products need to be made, services need to be delivered. And so entrepreneurship is a very good way like to do it. But also, I think therapy needs to be provided in prison too. A lot of people, unfortunately, in prison have experienced so many traumatic situations, and we got to address those. Like we got to treat people and address their mental health issues to allow them to reacclimate back to society.
Mm-hmm. And what about vocational education? I mean, your first business was in making furniture, right? Which was a skill that you learned in while you were in prison.
Right.
I was talking to somebody about vocational education, and they were saying that there are actually really good paying jobs and training programs. That a lot
Absolutely.
Of people are not aware of because everybody is kind of on a they have to go to college, which is fine if that's what you want to do. But there's also other options as well. So I'm just curious if in your vision of what you would want, you'd also want vocational education.
So I would agree with that, too. Right. So just like, you know, people always going to need plumbers or like masonry work and stuff done. And some of these industries are like a dying trade where the folks who are professionals in these spaces are retiring. And we need to pass these skill sets down for people because you always going to need people like to build some stuff. We always going to need carpenters and stuff like that. And, you know, that's like a recession-proof industry, like those trades. And so we definitely need that.
Mm-hmm. You have overcome so much and completely transformed your life in a situation that seems like it would have been impossible to do so. What would you say to someone else who is feeling that their life is difficult or maybe that they would like to change their life, but they don't think it's possible? What would you say to them?
So I would say to them first that it is possible to turn your life around, and there are a few things that you can do to do it. Like, one, first, you have to believe it. Two, you should write down what your plan is. Three, you should share your plan with someone and allow them to hold you accountable for checking stuff off your list. And then next would be surrounding yourself with amazing people or interviewing people who have been there and done it, who are successful. And then finally, it's just doing the work and never giving up. Just like work, just study and just try it and don't be afraid to fail. And, you know, that's worked out for me. That's worked out for a lot of people that I know. Like, it might not happen overnight, but you put the work in, it'll happen. It might take you a couple of years, but you can do it. And so that's what I would say to them.
Mm-hmm. It seems like part of what you did also was to change your mindset. I mean, you had, I think when people get defeated and have a lot of trauma, they start to believe that that's all that life is.
Right.
So how is it that you, What would you tell people about how to change their mindset? How to believe in themselves when maybe they haven't had very many people in their lives who believed in them?
Right. So honestly, I think I just mentioned this, is you always gonna have moments of doubt. There's always gonna be failures and stuff like that. But when I decided to surround myself with like good people, amazing people, when these moments happen, those are the people that's gonna lift you up. And so when stuff like that would happen, like my folks would encourage me to get back into the fight or get back to studying. And I still, to this day, I surround myself with people like that who like really push me, who care about me, who love me, and they keep me in the game.
Is there anything else that you think people should know about, I don't know, about that they don't maybe know or understand, either about life in prison or what it is we need to do to make that not the reality for so many people?
Well, I mean, that's a very existential question, but I think like what I would want people to know is that, especially like young people who like commit crimes, like we shouldn't throw them away. And their lives are redeemable, and we should give people opportunities. Like if we got to get punished and people are working really hard behind the fence, they should be allowed to come home and reacclimate to society. Like we shouldn't be cruel. Like that shouldn't be like what America stands for. Shouldn't be cruel. We shouldn't be like so reactive to stuff that happens. Let's be proactive. Let's learn to forgive people and let people like live. And I think like the world would be different. America would be different if we operated that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. That was
no
really great. Yeah. Is there anything else you want to add that I didn't ask or that you want to make sure?
I don't think so. But I mean, I would encourage people to follow my work through my website, chriswilson.biz.biz. I'm making art. I'm helping companies. And just trying to give back and pay it forward. So any support that people can give for me or advice, I definitely appreciate it.
Great. Well, I will make sure to tell people about your book. Well,
read the book too.
Yes, yeah,
but it's a good book.
It's a great book. It's really inspiring. Great. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate speaking with you.
No problem.
And I will let you know when this is scheduled to air. It'll probably be, I'm not sure because we have a schedule, but I'll let you know.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Have a good day.
You sure?
To start, could you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in Washington, D.C.? To start, could you tell us a little bit about where you grew up?